Hello and welcome to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. My name is Andrew Dalbo. I'll be here with Josh and Henry discussing all the good and bad about Arsenal Football Club. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to episode 23 of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. We're climbing, fellas, we're climbing. I'm here with Josh and Henry as usual. And as usual, it is a blooming rubbish day to be recording an Arsenal podcast. For the fourth time in a row, I think I read, is it 16 years since Arsenal have lost four games in a row?
Yep.
Is that right?
2002.
Yeah. So, if you needed an example of how bad this season is going, they are literally breaking records. That's how bad this is. The latest of those four losses was a 2-1 loss at Amex Stadium against Brighton. And to be honest, I wasn't even surprised. That was probably the most, I guess, the most damning indictment of it was Jamie Redknapp actually predicted a Brighton win in the studio. He said, "What do you think's going to happen?" He was like, "I think Brighton are going to win because Arsenal are rubbish." And well, he was right. Henry, has it depressed you as much as it's depressed everybody else?
Yeah, as I said to you guys just before we started, I have little left to say about this entire scenario. I mean, yeah, I'm deflated. Next question.
What else is there to say? We've been here for 5 years.
bump that a bit, would you mind?
Yeah. There's only so many points you can draw from the same thing happening for 5 years.
It's like we always seem to learn five new things every time, even though it's the same game.
Yeah, those five things we learned, they're not five new things we've learned. They're five things we have confirmed,
we've revised, learned, if you will.
Josh, are you as depressed as the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, I should say I was thankful for like the last 10 minutes before halftime because I was actually excited about Arsenal for the first time in like a month and a half. I was like, this is great, we're actually looking good, and then it ended, but... You know, yeah, it sucks. And I think it sucks even worse because it is the same thing, but it's the same thing with players that are, like, actually noteworthy. Like, we've got Aubameyang, we've got Ozil. These are all guys that have had a good deal of success, and they come here and they suck. And it's just amazing how that works.
Yeah, it is funny just how wrong everything is going. Yeah. And that is a good point that you make, that I guess, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, it was, you know, players like Johan Giroud and Philippe Senderos that were scuppering Arsenal's hopes. Now it's players like Mesut Ozil and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, you know, fully fledged stars, and even they can't overcome Arsene Wenger's stupidity. So,
or should we say Shkodran Mustafi, a World Cup winner, Laurent Koscielny, a full-on French international, and Petr Cech, who holds the most Premier League clean sheets ever.
How long has he been on 199 clean sheets?
I don't know.
They seem to talk about it every single game, and every game he doesn't quite.
And I always love when the opponent scores their first goal because they go, "Oh well, Petr Cech's gonna have to wait another game."
It seems like the camera just goes straight to him as well, and it's one of those depressed shots, and Cech's giving the
poor. I think I did see a stat the. It was early this season. I don't quite know how true this is, but apparently Cech has conceded more Premier League goals at Arsenal than he did at Chelsea. Yep.
How is that possible?
He's also conceded, this season, he's conceded the most goals of any other season, and we're only just started March. So.
Oh, gosh. This is going to be a podcast full of kind of that devilish humour where it's so bad that I can't do anything
I've
but laugh at how
myself
bad
as a
Arsenal
comedian,
are.
You know. So maybe this is my calling. Yeah.
I think every Arsenal fan does, really.
We are a comedy club, after all. Do you like that, fellas? Do you like that?
That was good. Yeah.
Do you think that's what Wenger is? Do you think he's just like a social experiment to see how much pain he can cause people, but how long he can stay there?
I don't know. I mean, loyalty's been brought up a bunch recently, hasn't it? And then there's these arguments, I turned down the world for Arsenal. And then the counter-argument being, well, if you're so loyal to the club... You would have known that 2-3 years ago it was best to step down and leave rather than take your close to £10 million salary a year. So, I don't know.
Right, that was a depressing opening to this podcast, but nevertheless, let's focus on, I'm going to say positives, but really I mean kind of relative not bads. There were when we were discussing the planning of this podcast, there were two players who we all thought were the best of the bad bunch. Henry, I'll give you the floor on this. In terms of, I guess we just want to focus on the guys who don't need to be completely vilified, because at the moment that's all that's happening among Arsenal circles. So, Henry, who do you think played close to average? Is what I'll give him.
I mean, before the game, I was concerned that Callum Chambers was lining up at right back, because instantly I had flashbacks of Jefferson Montero running past him at the Liberty Stadium. But despite the fact that Brighton targeted that side quite heavily, and especially in the second half, I thought he did quite well. I thought the space that they found on that left flank was more often due to the fact that we were chasing the game and leaving vast spaces, not due to the fact that Chambers was getting beat. And I also thought that Granit Xhaka played okay again. So there you go, Josh. You're welcome.
Yeah, Josh, do you want to give your gushing praise of your most favourite
of your emperor?
I do, yes. But I did want to jump in for Callum Chambers too, because I've been really high on his value, and I was nervous as well to see him at right back. But, I mean, he did as well as you could have expected. He's not a right back, and that becomes apparent all the time whenever he gets... I mean, it's just not in his nature. He's not fast enough, but... But every chance he had to actually make a difference on the defensive side, he did. And I think, again, it's just another testament to how well he can make a go of having a really solid Premier League career. Hopefully here, hopefully not somewhere else. And yes, Granit Xhaka was good. He was better than okay. I would say he was above average, which...
above average?
You know, I semi-jokingly said in a post-match article that even I was surprised by how well he's doing. I mean that in the sense that everybody seems to suck right now. Like, the whole team just doesn't care. And whenever that happens, that's when I look for who's playing decently, who's actually trying to step up. And Xhaka has been that guy. And I haven't met too much opposition on that. I mean, he might be ineffective, but he's one of the few guys that's still pushing and trying to make something happen. And I think a lot of credit has to go to him for that, especially because of one of the main criticisms was that he can get aloof at times. He can kind of zone out. If anything, he's been more focused than ever in these losses, which I think is a really, really good sign.
Yeah, I'm one of his biggest detractors. And even I would say that of the Arsenal players, he's been certainly one of the better few. There were still issues there. I thought how he defended... The first goal was poor when he was up against Ezequiel Schelotto. And admittedly, it was a difficult situation for him. But if you're the holding anchor midfielder, you have to be able to fill in for your fullbacks when they bomb forward. And he just isn't. Now, that isn't the type of player that he is. And I guess Arsenal or Wenger specifically needs to put him in positions that better suit his abilities. But while he's playing in that defensive midfield position, he needs to be able to at least find a way to just slow him down, even if he's not going to fully stop the supply or the cross.
I will say, you know, defense is obviously not his forte, but these past two games, I would say past three, but to be modest, I'll say past two, he's actually been a pretty good defensive midfielder. I say pretty good because I'm not going to gush over him too much, but... I mean, statistically, and I know statistics don't say everything, he has led the team twice now in winning the ball back, both through tackles and interceptions. And that's not something we've seen from him ever, not two games in a row. I mean, he's had these rare games where he puts in a lot of good tackles. But these past two and a half games, he's actually done really an improvement, I will say, on his defensive game, which there's still a long way to go. It is only 2-3 games. But, I mean, if he can keep building on that, on his new found defensive solidity, then I'm still optimistic that there's going to be a place for him.
I mean, I thought he was impressive from a defensive standpoint during the Carabao Cup final, so you could easily extend that to three. I thought he had some good actions, but it's as I've said previously, it's so difficult to say that players played well or above average when the performance as a whole and the attitude as a whole was so poor and so spineless.
No, it is hard, and I don't want to exclude him from responsibility because he absolutely deserves it. Everybody does. But like I said, I feel like while everyone else crumbled, he didn't allow himself to crumble, which I think does deserve a little specific mention that he wasn't as bad as everyone else.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's more than fair enough. Now let's get on to the really juicy stuff. Arsenal and their defending, and actually their goalkeeping as well. Do you want to go through it goal by goal? Is that the best way? And then we can discuss the shortcomings that presented themselves. So the first goal came from a corner. Obviously, I was mentioned there that Xhaka kind of was backing off from Schelotto, and I don't think he did very well there, but he was put in a tough situation. Petr Cech comes out for the corner, challenges with Shane Duffy. I think Cech wins the punch, doesn't he? Yeah. It comes off Cech's hand, but it goes back across the penalty area, lands straight at the feet at Lewis Dunk, who just knocks it in the empty net. Certainly not great from a goalkeeper who isn't renowned for his shot-stopping ability, and it really is in the team because he provides the confidence and the control and the command of a penalty area from aerial positions, and that's what he didn't do there.
I would argue that he is quite a good shot stopper, actually. I mean, granted, this season he hasn't been brilliant, but he kept us in the game for large parts of Sunday, and he's kept us in games before this season. So I would, whilst it's tough to say considering, again, he's in poor form, but is he a David De Gea? Certainly not, but I wouldn't say it's a drawback of his.
Do you think he's a better shot stopper than David Ospina?
Ooh, I think Ospina has better reflexes, but the thing is, I'm not confident with Ospina ever because I know, as weird as it sounds, and despite the fact that Cech has made many mistakes, I'm always fearful in every Ospina appearance that Ospina is going to make a mistake.
Yeah, and I agree completely, but I think the reason why Cech's in the team is because of those mistakes, not because of that he's a better shot stopper than Ospina. If I actually think Ospina's the better shot stopper of the two, but he does bring that air of uncertainty and doubt and that Cech is meant to exude calmness.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point considering his history within the league, his history at Chelsea, his record in terms of the most clean sheets. His distribution when compared to Ospina isn't great either. I mean, the Swansea game comes to mind instantly. So it's interesting now comparing the two side by side.
Even
if you were to offer me one of the, or either Cech or Ospina to start, I'd still say Cech every single time.
No, me too as well. But even on Sunday, there were moments where his distribution was, he got away with a couple of really, really dodgy kicks that it would just straight to the centre of the pitch. And didn't have the height or distance on. Josh, are you worried by Petr Cech's performance and by his potentially poor performances throughout the year?
I mean, yeah, but this is more of the same. I mean, it's not like we saw anything new. He didn't improve. What baffles me about Arsenal is that you've got these professionals like Petr Cech, like Laurent Koscielny, who everyone knows are among the best of their trade, and you see what they did against Brighton, and they were both horrible. I mean, Laurent Koscielny three times in a row just passed the ball away. Petr Cech was less than convincing. He made a lot of... I mean, I think I said this on the last podcast. It's amazing how such intelligent players can make such stupid decisions whenever they have no history of making these many stupid decisions in a row. And I don't understand it. I don't understand how your entire quality can just nosedive when you put on a different shirt. It doesn't make sense to me. But yes, I am worried.
I agree. I do think a long-term goalkeeper is something of need in the summer. Vucek Szczesny would have been the perfect...
Yeah. He can
perfect,
come home now if
the
he likes.
Man to
he can
replace
come and smoke in the dressing room now if he likes.
In fairness to Wenger, I think he only had 12 months left on his contract, didn't he? And I think it was probably fairly clear that he just wasn't going to sign a new contract, so he just had to let
him go.
That might
have been the case, but then you also hear about, or you heard about the way he spoke about the club, and part of me thinks that if you gave him the assurance, yes, you will be the number one, the long-term number one, as in, you ask these questions now that he's gone, but it's difficult because obviously we don't know. We don't know anything.
No.
But I would like to think that we gave him assurances that he would be our number one. And then if he left, fine. But if we didn't, then that's an issue. But obviously, as I said, we have no idea.
Yeah, no, I agree. The second goal was probably worse. Lauren Koscielny gave the ball away. Kolasinac charges after the ball, stupidly. Brighton then, with I think it one pass out to Pascal Gross on the wing, where Kolasinac should have been. The cross then comes in from Gross, who isn't charged down by Koscielny at all. And Mustafi forgets that Glenn Murray's a player, lets him wander behind him, and he just heads it home under Petacek, who I think it's harsh to blame him, but a good goalkeeper would have saved that. David De Gea would have saved that goal, put it that way. And if you're wanting to go after the title, then you need your goalkeeper to make the saves that most goalkeepers wouldn't make. And that is a prime example of one of them where, you know, that's a point for Manchester United right there if David De Gea goes and saves that. Josh, would you agree that really Kolasinac, Koscielny, Cech and Mustafi are all, perhaps not equally, but all share at least some portion of the blame for this, for the second goal?
Yeah, and I did want to point out that I know Chambers was close, but I don't hold him responsible for that. I mean, once he was from a wide angle, once he got behind Glenn Murray, there was going to be no winning it for him. It's hard to pin who was most responsible, but yeah, I agree that they were all involved with that wonderful, wonderful goal.
How does this keep happening? Like, how does it happen over and over and over and over again? It's like they don't understand the game of football. It's like football is about stopping goals and scoring goals. It's as if they forgot that half the game is about stopping the other team from scoring.
Well, they forgot the other half too.
I mean, for me, it's more of if you stop the cross, or you at least put pressure on the cross, as we discussed earlier, it's far less likely that that second goal even occurs. Yeah. Because Koscielny's quite far wide. I believe he's actually essentially on the... he's near the edge of the penalty box. So naturally, Mustafi has to step inside. He has to get between man and ball anyway. I think more than anything, it's a fantastic ball. Could it have been defended better? Yes, most certainly. Originally, I was very, very frustrated with Mustafi's positioning, but the more I look at it, the more I understand it. When you play so often and you realise, actually, he's supposed to shift over anyway. And it was so difficult for Chambers to get back over because of the way that we'd set up from the goal kick, spread wide, to give everyone plenty of space to receive the ball and to begin playing football. But then again, I have no idea what we try and do when we attack. Next, please.
Quick transitions of play do make it extremely difficult for defenders, where the ball's turned over high up the pitch and they're a bit confused and everybody's position is a little bit out of whack because the team thinks that they're in safe possession of the ball. When they suddenly lose it, those huge spaces between the two centre halves are there because they've specifically split wide because they've got the ball and then they don't have the ball. So I agree. Certainly Mustafi didn't cover himself in glory and certainly he didn't defend it well. I would apportion more blame to Kolasinac and Koscielny because the cross has to be inch perfect and it's from a long way away. If you put even an ounce of pressure on that ball, it is not going to be as precise as it was. And that was how precise it needed to be. If that was an inch low or an inch higher, they would not have scored that goal. So you have to be able to charge that down, even if you don't block it, just to at least make Gross doubt that he can put in such an accurate ball. But there you go, this is Arsenal we're talking about, and they don't do the simple things. Henry, I know you wanted to talk about the responsibility of players and the myriad of apologies that we're getting on social media after the games. So obviously Petacek put one out. It was almost straight after full time, wasn't it? What did you think of that?
Well, I admire this acceptance of the blame, if you will, and this sense of responsibility. as Josh said before we started, I'm tired of the apologies. I'm tired of everything simply because, as we've already alluded to, this has been going on for so long. I mean, I wish the sense of responsibility extended to the board, to the manager himself as well. But, yeah, I'm just tired. I mean, there are no words to describe my feelings about this anymore. I'm frustrated and I'm angry, but I just feel so deflated when discussing it simply because my friends have been making fun of the entire situation for so long at this point. I have nothing to rebuttal with because I've used all of my arguments. There's nothing left.
It very much feels like actions speak louder than words, and the apologies and to be fair, Trek's apology is far better than most people's because he literally says, "I cannot play that badly if we as a team expect to win games." That's basically what he said, which is extremely frank, extremely honest. You compare that to Wilshere's apology after the cup final, where he had a sly dig at the ref, and he's just like, "Well, just own up, just man up on your mistakes, and say, you know what, actually, that was my fault. That's on me. I apologise." So I have a lot more respect for Cech's apology in isolation. But certainly in context, there's just too many of them, and they don't. It feels like they don't mean anything, does it? Really? Do you agree, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, you said it when you said actions speak louder than words, and that's. I'm not just doing this as propaganda, but that's why I've been so enthused with Granit Xhaka lately, because he might not be one of the people coming out and saying, "I'm so sorry, I screwed up." I'm sorry. It's easy to get on Twitter after you lose and say, "Sorry, I'll do better next time."
Yeah.
It's a hell of a lot harder to actually do better next time. And right now, no, very, very, very few people have actually stepped up and done something about it. And whenever they do, it's like a drop of water in the ocean. It's like it doesn't have any effect because it has to be a concerted team effort if you're going to actually make a change. And that it goes beyond, it goes beyond Twitter apologies. It goes beyond the manager or the board. It has to be everybody coming together as one, and it's just not happening. And it's not going to happen from people saying they're sorry on Twitter. It's going to happen from somebody stepping up on the pitch and other people following that lead, which, with the cast that we have, looks like it's just not going to happen.
For me, it stems from the culture of the Colt Club, the culture of, I guess, acceptance and nicety and an unwillingness to challenge one another. And complacency, a fear of being critical of somebody else and saying, actually, that's not good enough. You need to do better than that. Arsenal don't have that type of person. I know Alan Pardew was getting questioned about West Brom's recent antics and talking about a lot of the arguments and discussions that have been having in their dressing room. And essentially he said, and I thought he answered the questions very well, he basically said, "Well, if I'm in a team that's doing as badly as we are, I wouldn't want my players to be happy. I would want my players to be angry. I'd want there to be arguments. I'd want there to be debates and not necessarily fights, but at least kind of heated discussions about what's going on and about how to fix it, because that shows that they care." And at Arsenal, I have very, very little confidence that that is happening behind the scenes. And like you said, it's in their actions. They don't look like they're trying to change things on the pitch, do they? It just looks like the same old dejected resignation.
Although
really,
there was a piece that came out, I can't remember which publication released this piece about this supposed team meeting where players came forward and were supposedly very emotional. But again, it just seems
it was
a bit
the,
like... Carry on. What were you going to say, Andy?
It was The Guardian that published the piece, and it was very interesting.
Yeah, but that was before Brighton, and then they came out and did the exact same thing against Brighton, so clearly the meeting didn't do anything.
I mean, it's just a case of... I put that in the same category as the Twitter apologies. I assume that they've had many meetings like that over the past 10 years or so. Maybe with a lot of the same players. Granted, I think this situation that we find ourselves in now is much, much worse. Much, much worse might be a tad dramatic, but certainly worse. But it's certainly interesting considering very rarely do you get leaks. I mean, I'm not sure how authentic the piece is, but it's very rare that you have pieces like that hit the press.
And it's not just the fact that Arsenal are losing. It's the manner in which they're doing it. So when we're saying, oh, we want them to do better, it's not that I obviously want them to win, but it's not that they're not winning that's frustrating. It's the way in which they're not winning that is so annoying. If you put your best effort and you lose, then that's fair enough. That there's literally nothing more that you could have done. And that's all that fans, I think, are asking of these players, is to commit their fullest and try their hardest and do their best. And that's just not happening at the moment. It's fairly obvious that for whatever reason, whether it be Wenger being unable to motivate them, whether it be the players just don't really care, whether it be the whole culture of the club, the whole atmosphere that kind of engulfs the team is a bit kind of suffocating, and just people aren't able to flourish in that environment. I don't know, but they're just clearly, or at least it looks like, that they're not trying their hardest. They're not trying their best.
And it's so frustrating to hear Arsene Wenger come out after the game and say, "Trust me, I can turn this team around." Clearly, you can't, or you would have already. I kind of see it the same way as I see the Twitter apologies. All you can keep talking and keep talking, but there comes a point in time, and I think we've passed this a long time ago, where we don't trust you at your face value anymore. You keep saying the same things. Mm. Nothing ever changes, but you're going to keep saying them anyway because nobody wants to admit that they're not good enough. They're just going to sulk and cry, and you know, you may get that the rare good performance when everything happens to click, but if you can't make these things happen, then you're just going to be at the whim of whoever you're playing against, and then you're going to keep falling farther and farther, and nobody's in a position to change that right now.
I mean, when we had that 5-10 minutes of intensity, if you will, before the halftime interval against Brighton, I was actually very excited, and I was probably misled almost by that intensity. I actually thought going into the second half, okay, let's at least have a performance during the second half that we can be proud of. But then even when you look at that funny statistic about expected goals, you realise that we didn't actually create anything of note in the second half either. We obviously hit the post following, was it just before our Aubameyang's goal?
Just before half time, yeah.
But other than that, I cannot remember any chance of note. I just can't. And I completely agree with everything that you said. I trust nothing now at face value. I mean, I don't really anyway, but certainly not in terms of Arsenal Football Club.
I will say Aubameyang had one other decent volley at goal. I don't remember how it was set up, but I think that was the last really obvious chance that we had. The rest was just Iwobi or Mkhitaryan dribbling the ball up to Ryan and nothing coming from it.
But even, I do remember the volley, even then it wasn't a chance where it was like, oh, he has to score that. Yeah. It was a bit of a, perhaps that goes in, 2-2 in 10, something like that, 3-10. But actually, it wasn't like a real guilt-edged opportunity where, like, I can't believe he hasn't failed to score that. Or that's an incredible save, or that's a really good effort and very unlucky. Or it was just a fairly standard chance, wasn't it, from the edge of the area. Unfortunately, to be honest, it just looks like at the moment this team just isn't good enough. Not only do they not care, they're just not very good. There's lack ability, and I guess. I guess we'll start to shift to our perspective in the second half towards the Milan game. But if this team isn't good enough, then the rest of the season is going to be very, very, very depressing indeed.
I mean, again, we've said it so many times, effort, passion, the lack of organisation. We look like we're going to concede every time we concede a set piece. Oh, it's just infuriating. And I'm ranting now. Josh, take the lead.
I will say, I forget where I heard it. I think it was while I was watching the match, but one of the commentators was kind enough to remind me that this is usually what happens in February for Arsenal. Not this bad, usually, but we always tank in the winter months, and then there's always this charge at the end of the season where they fool us into thinking things are different. I would not at all be surprised if we turn it around, and I mean, I would love to say I'm not going to fall for it this time, but let's be honest, I probably will. I know we talked about this last podcast, but it feels like every time there is a new season underway, we think, well, this everything's different now. And it.
I'll be there. I'll be there.
I'll be on that. I'll be there as well. Don't you worry.
With my Wenger in.
No.
I'll be there.
we've got 3 months now until the end of the season, and I would not be surprised if we limit the gap to the top four. I don't think we're going to get there. Everybody's admitting that now. But I bet we limit the gap and make it look a hell of a lot closer than it really was.
Yeah. I mean, but I know we mentioned in the last podcast when Arsenal kind of finished second and third, and they didn't really finish second and third. It was kind of like a fake second and third, wasn't it, where they kind of snuck in. And I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing happens this season.
That's one of the only occasions that I can remember where the table lied, as in...
Yeah.
It's a pretty good indication.
Yeah, the table definitely lies. I mean, one of my good mates is a Newcastle fan. They were playing Bournemouth the other day. They were 2-0 up. And I think they were in the top half after about 60 minutes of the games. Ended up drawing 2-2, and I think by the end of the Saturday they were in 16th position because it's so tight. And that's kind of proof that the table is not actually always as accurate as it may seem to be. One way that we will see Arsenal test themselves and prove how truly rubbish they are is on Thursday night when they travel to Milan in what is now, I would argue, the most important game of the season. So, in a second, we will all depress ourselves even further by looking at how Milan are going to absolutely rip Arsenal apart on Thursday night. We'll see you in a second. Hello and welcome back to the second part of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. I'm here with Josh and Henry as usual. My name is Andrew Dowswell and we are looking forward to Thursday night's trip to Milan where, Henry, Arsenal are going to get battered, right?
Well, I couldn't understand what you just said there. You said we're looking forward. Are you really looking forward to this? I mean, I'm looking forward to the fixture itself, a clash of titans, but... Yeah, I'm excited we're going to Milan and we're going to all these extravagant places. Extravagant may be a bit strong, but yeah, my feeling is that we're going to get thoroughly exposed once again.
Yeah. Milan are in excellent form and we'll touch on that in a minute, but I'm not confident. Are you confident at all, Josh?
For the sake of not being the most depressing Arsenal podcast in the world, yes, I am confident because I believe that at some point in the foreseeable future, I have no idea when that will be, our offense will realize, our attack will realize who they have and they will just start clicking. I don't know how it's going to happen. I have no theories on how we can get it to happen, but I just feel like at some point when you put Ozil and Mkhitaryan, and I mean, we don't have Aubameyang, but eventually... they've got to come out of their funk, right? That makes sense. Eventually they have to, right? Why not Thursday?
Yeah, I mean, I guess by probability they're going to win a game eventually. If you just play 100 games, they might eventually win one of them. But I'm not especially confident on that front. Milan also, obviously, the death of Fiorentina captain Astori is extremely sad, and our condolences to him and his family and all those affected. Because of that, Milan didn't have a game on the weekend. So not only are they a team in good form, they're unbeaten in their last 13 games. They're also now a well-rested team. That only makes life more difficult for Arsenal. I guess the question I really want to ask you, Henry, is how do you think Wenger will set up knowing how well Milan are playing at the moment and knowing that he doesn't have Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang as a centre-forward and I've not read anything on this, but likely doesn't have Alexander Lacazette either.
It wouldn't surprise me to see Mohamed Elneny come back in.
Yep.
It wouldn't surprise me either if Nketiah started, because if there was one little positive from the weekend is I quite enjoyed his little cameo. And it also wouldn't surprise me if Callum Chambers started at centre-back instead of one of Mustafi or Koscielny. I mean, I personally wouldn't do it, but it wouldn't surprise me. I think Bellerin will obviously come back in and Ospina will obviously come back in as the Europa League goalkeeper. But I think we'll see a few changes. Ramsey could be back in as well, obviously, seeing as he was rested.
Do you think he could be tempted to go to a back three?
What, with Elneny as the centre-back, as the central centre-back?
No. With Chambers as the centre-half and Xhaka and Ramsey in midfield?
Possibly. What With the Carabao Cup final, it was more, in my opinion, this element of unpredictability being the reason that we reverted back to the three or the five at the back, more than anything else. And perhaps we might do it for a similar reason against Milan. But it's so weird, simply because at this point, I can't tell you which formation offers us more hope of coming away with a positive result.
I don't think any formation offers us more hope with coming away with a positive result. But I guess my thinking is that, A, it's away from home, so keeping a clean sheet would be extremely valuable. And Wenger has this year, in competitions when he went to Stamford Bridge in the Carabao Cup, set up his team to not concede. That was the primary purpose of his team's performance. Wouldn't be surprised if he does a similar thing here. And also, Arsenal don't actually have that many attacking players to choose from. With Lacazette and Aubameyang both not there, you only have to play three attacking players in the 3-4-3. So you can play Ozil and Mkhitaryan either side of Daniel Welbeck or Nketiah, as you say, or you could even play Iwobi there and play kind of without a striker, or something like that, where the formation essentially allows Wenger to play less players at positions where his personnel is weaker.
I mean, you referred to the wanting to keep defensive solidarity in big away games this season. That's just made me think that we may see Iwobi and Welbeck start. I think that was one of the reasons why Iwobi started. I don't think he started the Carabao Cup final, but he started the Premier League game afterwards, if I'm not mistaken, to neutralise...
Welbeck did.
Or...
Welbeck did.
What, Welbeck started?
Against...
In the Carabao Cup final?
In the Premier League against City.
Well, my mind is completely frazzled.
To be fair, the games...
Carl Walker, wasn't it? But, yeah.
Yeah, to be fair, the games were so bad that I've also forgotten most of the details from them. Yeah. Just chosen to not remember them. Yeah, so Iwobi started against Brighton and was pants. Welbeck started against City and was equally as pants. So neither of them are especially great options to have, to be honest. Josh, would you start either Iwobi or Welbeck on Thursday? Obviously, Lacazette and Aubameyang not being there.
No, I was actually putting together my starting 11, and I went with the back three with Chambers, Mustafi, Koscielny, and then Klasnik, Bellerin. I put Elneny and Xhaka in the midfield, and I was like, you know, I don't even want a striker. Let's just start Mkhitaryan, Ramsey, and Ozil. Honestly, I have more faith in Ramsey to play a false nine with late runs than I do in Welbeck or Iwobi to score.
I thought you were going to kick Ramsey out wide again. I was like, Josh, no.
No, he's playing centrally.
Would you play Ramsey instead of Elneny and play Wilshere like he did in the Carabao Cup final as a part of the front three, possibly?
Yes, but I don't think I think Arsene Wenger's got this thing going where he alternates Ramsey and Wilshere. He blames it on injuries. I think it's more so just he wants to alternate them, which I made this point in an article on the website. It's a bold decision, but I see where he's coming from. I mean, these are two really important players that have always been plagued with exhaustion and getting hurt when they're asked to do too much. So he's alternating them, which obviously we want to see them because they're two of our more exciting players, but I don't know. I mean, however we line up, I would legitimately rather not have a striker and just pile the midfield. Because, I mean, when you think of Ozil and Mkhitaryan sending balls into the box, Welbeck, even if he is in the box, which he rarely is just as likely to score, or is less likely to score than a late Ramsey run, who I think is more often in the box than Welbeck is, than Iwobi is. So, yeah, I mean, it started out as, oops, I forgot to put in a striker, and then I was like, well, since I've done it, I don't want a striker.
I mean,
Welbeck's more likely to score an own goal than he is a goal from a cross.
Unintentional.
Get to the penalty area.
The right words.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things I really, really am frustrated by is when we have the ball or we have possession of the ball, there are so few players in the opposition box. I'm like, that's how you score, not by all of you being 25 yards out. Get close to goal. It was when we scored, I was like, we had two people in the box, not with the fact that we scored. We have a couple of people in the box. But one thing I would say is that if we went without a striker, which I think is incredibly unlikely anyway, our counter-attack would be even slower than it already is, and we'd be relying even more on Shkodran Mustafi to lead the charge. he seems to do that better than he defends at the moment anyway, so why not give that mantra to him?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to say there was a time against Brighton where we had just gotten the ball back and we were on this great counterattack, and as soon as we crossed the midfield point, we just slowed down and all the Brighton players flowed back into shape, and we just said, you know what, you guys go ahead and get set. We want to make sure that you're ready before we attack you, because it, yeah, I guess it's a gentleman's
game. We really
game.
Want to impress you. We really want to show you what we got.
It's like, I don't understand. Our inability to counterattack is just astounding, and I don't know if it's not like we don't have athletic players. We've got Klasnek. I mean, Mkhitaryan is pretty quick. We've got all of these guys that can make the runs. They just choose not to. And even, you know, Jock is slow, but he's decent at getting the ball out of his feet quickly, headed the other direction. I don't know who, I mean, maybe Ozil's lack of pace hurts us on the counter, but it's so hard to ascertain what your mindset would be whenever you say, okay, we're moving quick, we're ahead of their defense, let's slow down, we're going too fast. I don't
even think Ozil's that slow. I think he's deceptively quick. But they just don't counterattack. And you've got arguably the best counterattacking striker in world football. Like that, this is his thing. This is Aubameyang 101 is the bent run on the counterattack from the edge of the halfway line where he's in his own half, so he's there for onside. That's like that's what he's there for, and we just don't utilize it at all.
I mean, what I would say is that the comparison of tactics between ourselves and Dortmund is fascinating in terms of they obviously operate a very high press, so they can win the ball back, and they obviously, yeah, you know, the space that we talked about in transition earlier, they have that to exploit. We don't do that. We are very much get back in a shape, then we'll win the ball, then we'll slowly pass the ball sideways up the field, and then we'll try and bore you to death to score. I mean, that's how we do it, yeah. And it drives me nuts, and it's partly one of the reasons why I wanted Giroud to stay, because at least then you can have a figurehead to something and you can vary it by having a focal point.
As you were describing how we attack, I could picture at least 10 different examples of times we have done that in the past like 2 weeks. So thank you for those recurring nightmares that I just had.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it is a pretty, it just lacks instruction. You look at he's the talk of the town at the moment, but you look at Pep Guardiola at Manchester City, they just know. There was a pass the other day, I was watching the City-Chelsea game, there was a pass where De Bruyne got the ball in midfield and he kind of wiggled past the defender and then without even looking played a pass wide to the left and there was nobody there and it actually went out for a throw-in. But you could see that he has been told, when you get the ball in this position, pass it here where player X will be stood, because Guardiola has drilled that instruction into him of this is what you do in this situation. And Arsenal have none of that. What they do when they're in this situation, they slowly pass it, they kind of all stand in a semicircle with the two fullbacks as the two most attacking players out wide, and then the winger, I say the winger, like the inside forward winger,
inverted winger,
who doesn't get, they don't get in the box. They come and sit deeper than the fullback.
They sit on like the, then you have, on the edge of the box between, on the, I'm not yeah, sure what you call it, but where the two lines meet in the penalty area of the penalty box. They just stand there.
Yeah, and then you have the centre midfielder inside. Then you have Granit Xhaka as the deepest lying central. Then you have the other centre midfielder, the other inverted winger, the other fullback on the other wing, and then just one striker in the middle, marked by four players.
There are honestly times where you look at the television screen and there's just a clean blue line. I thought, where are the black shirts? Where are the black shirts? It's just a clean blue and white defensive line and there's no one even looking to break through or make a run or to hold someone off. It was just, I mean, it might sound basic.
The movement is terrible.
Really tetchy, but
because there is no movement.
It's basic. It's a case of, you're taught this again from when you're very young. You're most likely to score if you're in the box.
Yeah, and you go and you sign Aubameyang, who, as you said, is great in space, and you sell Giroud, who is great whenever he has to be in situations like that, and you still play the game like you have Giroud, ignoring that you have Aubameyang. And it's just like, I just wonder how long it will take them to realize they don't actually have Giroud anymore, because you can't keep playing the way you've always played. And I mean, even when we got Lacazette, it was the same thing. It was, we're not going to play the way that he should play. We're going to play the way we've always played with Giroud, and he's going to have to adjust, which he's obviously not going to. That's not the way he plays. And it's just, it's so counterintuitive. I would love to just get like a summary of what Arsenal has worked on in training for the past 2 years. I would love to see what they work on, because I don't know if this like Arsenal way is like a scientific formula that Arsene Wenger is just drilling into their heads, but it's not working, and it hasn't worked for a long time. And I don't know why it's so hard for anyone to realize it.
I mean, I know there's an emphasis on stretching and yoga, and despite the fact we seem to have injuries all the time, I mean, supposedly there's an emphasis on that. Wenger's renowned for bringing that over and prolonging the careers of our fantastic back four all those years ago. But then you see videos on YouTube and Twitter all the time of that passing drill that they do. It's like a 5v2 circle. They do that a lot, it seems. But other than that, I'm not familiar with what they do. So it would be interesting to know.
But that's what Pep Guardiola does, and he's magic. And Wenger is very much not magic. Like, he's that crap magician at school who thinks they can do card tricks, and then they drop the two of spades out like the back pocket. You're like, well, that didn't work. That's what Wenger does. And then Guardiola does exactly the same thing, apart from the two of spades is like illuminated onto the moon.
Oh.
And that's how you realise that this card's there. Like, it just, they do the same thing, but the different results is ridiculous. I can't believe how stupid he is. Like, it's unbelievable. It is completely, the word is counterintuitive. It's completely counterintuitive. And this is a guy who's meant to be so intelligent and so aware and so understanding of football and how football works and tactically so astute. And he completely revolutionized the game, and yet he can't see this fairly obvious thing.
And the more baffling thing about it is nobody doubts how much he loves Arsenal. He lives for Arsenal. You'd think that if there was ever a person that's going to realize that something has to adjust or change, it would be somebody who literally lives for the club. Maybe he's blinded by how much he loves the club. I don't know. It really, like you said, it's just counterintuitive. It doesn't make any sense why it's gotten like this.
Anyway, we have got slightly distracted from the fact that we play Milan on Thursday. So to slightly wrap up and get us back on track, Henry, I'm going to ask you for a score prediction against a team that are unbeaten in 13 games.
Well, they've also kept 6 consecutive clean sheets as well, and they're 6 unbeaten at home. 5 clean sheets in their last 6 at home.
They've only surrendered 3 goals in 10 games, and Arsenal have given up 17 goals in 10 games.
Yay. I'm going to say 2-0 AC Milan. That was hard.
2-0
AC Milan.
Josh, what do you think?
The eternal optimist. My goodness.
I have this running thing of never predicting a loss.
Do it.
No.
Do it.
No. Is he going to break it?
No, I'm not going to predict a loss. I think it's going to be, I think it'll be a 1-1 all draw.
That's a good result, though. That's a good result. I take that.
It would be
fantastic.
Fight
your hand off for that.
Even as I say that, I'm like, man, do I really believe this, or am I just trying to not predict a loss? But I'm gonna try to convince myself that I believe it.
I don't know. I assume away goals in the Europa League work the same way as they do in the Champions League. Is that right?
Yeah.
If you offered me a 2-1 loss right now, I would probably take it.
Me too.
I think.
Because you still go into the second leg with the mindset, we're still in this game. And as you said, we have this tradition, if you will, of turning up late in the season. Granted, not in European competition, but you never know. It's the mindset and the environment.
That's a good point. It's actually ironic that usually Arsenal crumble in Europe and then do okay domestically. This time around, they've crumbled domestically, so maybe they might not crumble in Europe. I mean, it's the only thread of hope I've got to hang on to, but there we go.
And let's be honest. Let's continue this trend of optimism, or this train of optimism, whilst we have it. I mean, we've been saying all year, whilst being brutally honest, the Europa League is the priority. This is it. This is for Wenger. This is everything. If we are beaten by AC Milan, I can honestly see Stan Kroenke, who, as I said, has been an absentee landlord, coming and saying, right, now something needs to change, because we're not going to be making the money that I want to be making. I don't know. Am I kidding myself by saying that?
Yeah, Stan Kroenke's not going to do anything about this.
Yeah, but Josh Kroenke, he is a revolutionary, that guy, I'm telling you.
He knows so much about the club. He had to take a specific trip to learn more about the club.
Yeah.
I'm going to predict I'm going to predict a 2-1 loss. I'm going to predict a 2... No, I'm not. I'm going to predict a 1-0 loss. I don't think we score. A 1-0 loss. A hard-earned 1-0 loss. That's what I'm going to predict. And I think he plays well back up front.
Oh, actually, can I change mine to 2-1? Because I'm going to continue my thought process of optimism. 2-1. 2-1 Milan.
To Arsenal?
No, to Milan. To
Arsenal. You think Arsenal are going to win 2-1 against Milan?
No, I'm not that optimistic. I'm optimistic we're going to get a second goal in 2 games, but...
Yeah.
We scored a goal.
Thank you. Do you see that German team? I think it was last year. Was it a German
team?
They basically didn't. They didn't score in like 10 games, so all the fans bought these massive arrows and pointed to where the goal was. I think that's what Arsenal should do. That at both ends, they should point away from the goal where they're defending.
Oh no, they should put them at halftime side to side like they do when they have.
And then at halftime, swap and then start pointing towards the goal for the attack because they're so bad.
Don't go forward, get defensive shape so that you're prepared for the counter attack.
I bet that's what Wenger's doing in training. You're getting him to work with arrows. It's just all he's doing. That's how bad they are. But it's quite a confusing system, so it doesn't quite translate to success on the pitch, as we have been seeing. I think we should end it there, guys.
Yeah, I'm a bit upset now.
Yeah, so am I. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. My name's been Andrew. I've been with Josh and Henry. As usual, you can find us on Twitter and on paininthearsenal.com and all the other places. So, you know, go and search for us and get in contact with us. If you've got any questions, then send them our way and we'll do our best to answer them. We hope that we are speaking to you on more positive terms after an inevitable win in Milan. But let's be honest, that's probably not going to happen. We will see you later this week. Goodbye.